This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
I'm Nicola Coughlin, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Youngest Heroes. Rebellion, risk, and the radical power of youth.
She thought, right, I'll just do it. She thought about others rather than herself.
12 stories of extraordinary young people from across history.
There's a real sense of urgency in them, that resistance has to be mounted, it has to be mounted now.
Follow History's Youngest Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 4th of February. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has become the first foreign leader to get a face-to-face meeting with Donald Trump at the White House since Mr. Trump returned to power. We keep an ear across their discussions at a key moment in the Gaza ceasefire for hostage deal and ask what each of them wants from the meeting. We speak to a former Trump administration official and get the view from Israel. Also on the programme, a deadly shooting at an adult education centre in Sweden. Controversy as Queen's University Belfast opens a campus abroad while cutting jobs at home. Plus the bacteria threatening liquid gold and what's behind the current scramble for rare earths. Now, we have seen much of the Oval Office since Donald Trump was inaugurated just over 2 weeks ago. Hardly a day has gone by without Mr. Trump signing executive orders in front of the cameras there. But until today, no foreign leader had been through its doors. That all changed when the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu became the first one to get the coveted invitation. He arrived shortly ago. He is sitting now with Mr. Trump in front of a raging fire. They're taking questions from reporters. We'll dip into that. We'll hear what they've been talking about in a moment. But their meeting comes at a critical time for the Middle East, with the Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal potentially moving into its second phase, one that's supposed to involve the release of the remaining hostages and a full Israeli pullout from the Gaza Strip. But there are huge challenges standing in the way of that. In the background to today's meeting, there were protesters outside the White House, among them a former hostage, Ilana Gritsevsky. She had this message for Mr. Trump.
If this deal falls apart, the hostage will die. You know it. I know it. And you are the only one who can stop it from happening. Please, President Trump, don't let them be forgotten.
And there was a message from the Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour. He said the wishes of the Palestinian people remained unchanged.
About the meeting in Washington, D.C., we want the ceasefire to be permanent. We want the implementation of all provisions of the agreement in all the stages and all elements. And also we want the aggression on the West Bank to stop and to the withdrawal of the Israeli forces from the cities and the refugee camps from the northern part of the Gaza Strip. These are the positions not only of the Palestinians, but also of the Arabs and the Muslim countries. And we sincerely hope that that will be the case.
Well, as President Trump sat down with Benjamin Netanyahu, he had this to say.
We want peace. We want people to stop being killed. And he wants peace also.
Mr. President, do you think it's politically possible in Israel to get this deal done until the end?
To get the deal done?
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, is it politically
Why wouldn't a deal get done? A deal can get done. We'll see what happens. We're dealing with very complicated people, but a deal can absolutely get done.
Ah, Mr. Trump was asked what the future held for Palestinians in Gaza.
You can't live in Gaza right now, and I think we need another location. I think it should be a location that's going to make people happy. You look over the decades, it's all death in Gaza. This has been happening for years. It's all death. If we can get a beautiful area to resettle people permanently in nice homes and where they can be happy and not be shot, not be killed, not be knifed to death like what's happening in Gaza. And right now you have in Gaza a very dangerous situation in terms of explosives all over the place, in terms of tunnels that nobody knows who's in the tunnel. The whole thing is a mess.
Well, we can join our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman, who is on the line from Washington. We're also joined from Israel by Tal Schneider, political and diplomatic correspondent for The Times of Israel. Welcome both of you. Tom, first of all, well, those comments from Donald Trump about Palestinians living in Gaza, reiterating what he said a few days ago, will not go down well amongst Palestinians and indeed amongst the Arab nations.
Well, they absolutely won't. And I mean, you know, it's interesting that we saw the first sort of suggestion of these kind of comments around 10 days ago or so now. And at first they felt like perhaps, well, this was perhaps an off-the-cuff remark. But it's clear it is not, because we're hearing them both from Mr. Trump and from officials around him who are trying to sort of explain what he means. But fundamentally, the same point remains that they are talking. You heard there about him talking about using the words permanently resettling Palestinians from Gaza. He's called on Egypt and Jordan to take them. They have said in no uncertain terms, no. Arab leaders over the weekend described this as something that would only lead to destabilization in the region, to further conflict. They, of course, will see this as forcible displacement of expulsion of Palestinians. And given the historical nature of the conflict, which is a territorial conflict fundamentally, and you're talking about a refugee population, that is going to, I think, trigger even more deep concern among Arab leaders, given that statement at the weekend. But it seems to be the direction that the White House is going with this.
I mean, Tal, we are, of course, at this point in the deal where we are entering the second phase, and that should involve, well, not Palestinians leaving Gaza, but Israeli forces completely leaving Gaza. How do you fit these talks into the context of those broader discussions over prolonging this deal?
Well, obviously, in order to get the IDF pulling out completely, there is a political problem in Israel, because Netanyahu, the prime minister, doesn't have the backing of his coalition partners. But with the suggestion that Trump just put really bluntly on the table, he actually helps, I suppose he helps Netanyahu with his, you know, very, very right-wing partners. They may, I mean, at least maybe one of them may be convinced to stay in if this is what the future entails for Gaza. I mean, it's hard for me to really explain that, because I know Egypt objecting and Jordan objecting, and I don't know if the Palestinians in Gaza will agree to that. But you know, it's like they're talking above the people's heads. But this may be like you know, a persuasive element for Netanyahu's friends to stay in government, and then his government will be saved, along with maybe a complete pullout from Gaza and end of the war, and obviously the return of all of the hostages, all of them.
Tom, looking at it from Washington, we're hearing, I think, Donald Trump saying, look, if I had been in office, October the 7th would never have happened. He said that before. But in terms of anything about this second phase of the ceasefire deal, are we getting anything from the White House?
Well, there is progress in the sense that Benjamin Netanyahu met Steve Witkoff, Mr. Trump's envoy to the region, in Washington last night. After that meeting, Mr. Netanyahu vowed to send a technical level delegation to Doha and for his security cabinet to meet in Israel with a view to, you know, the way in which they will try to push forward towards the second phase of the deal. I think where there is likely to be some potential tensions between President and Prime Minister here is over the speed with which that might be done and the level of commitment that Mr. Netanyahu has to it. Because what he has repeatedly said is he won't commit to an end to the war, a withdrawal of Israeli troops, while there is still the possibility for Hamas control or governance in Gaza. Now, that is something that I think Mr. Trump would, of course, agree with. But he, on the other hand, just wants the thing off his plate. He wants the deal done, largely because he wants to be able to move to his broader goal, which is a regional arrangement, a sort of three-way deal between the United States, Saudi Arabia and Israel, which would be the crowning achievement of his so-called Abraham Accords and normalization deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia. That's the thing he wants his legacy to be, as the big deal maker in the Middle East. But of course, he has to get the ceasefire and hostage release completed first. If we thought that getting the first phase agreed was hard, getting the second phase agreed is potentially even harder, because it will see both sides have to release the sort of raw and brutal power and leverage that they have over the other to get there. And that is potentially a very big ask and a very, very tough negotiation.
Tal, Benjamin Netanyahu is the first leader to get this meeting with Donald Trump since his re-election. But others will be coming, as he said. I mean, the Saudis are going to be meeting him as well. And he said today, Donald Trump, that, that the Saudis do not insist on a Palestinian state. I mean, it's going to be tricky for him, isn't it, to keep all these plates spinning?
Well, that's that statement contradicts everything we heard from the Saudis on record for years. They kept saying that they will not move forward with anything without a Palestinian state. So, I mean, I find it hard. You know, maybe he can convince them. But again, you know, the Egyptians are saying they will not agree for the Gazans to let in. And maybe, you know, Trump just said, you know, President Trump just said, they disagree with me, but they will do it. So he's very, you know, convinced that he can get around those leaders in the region. You know, maybe. I don't know.
Well, yes, a lot of people don't quite know. But just finally, Tom, look, on this point that he's coming back to, talking about Palestinians leaving Gaza, there are international sort of norms, aren't there, and international sort of legal frameworks that have to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and that's why this sort of idea being sort of plucked from the air and then developed over the days is one that's pretty tricky to get your head around. But I think it really struck me today when both Mike Waltz, his national security advisor, and Steve Witkoff, his envoy to the region, were talking in really quite serious terms about this. It's now basically being the policy, because they have said the way they're framing this is saying the level of destruction is so great that you couldn't rebuild homes and make it livable in Gaza for at least 15 years. And therefore, they're framing this as a humanitarian gesture. As I say, of course, for Palestinians and for the Arab world, they would see it as nothing short of expulsion, particularly given the language that Mr. Trump just used about permanent resettlement. And so you have to then ask the question, well, you know, fundamentally, the basis of this conflict has been Palestinians claiming their right to remain on the land. And so how would Palestinians be sort of removed from Gaza? So there's a whole range, huge amount of questions, not to mention, as you say, the entire position of international law, which makes forcible transfer illegal. And so not only are we in a sort of, you know, now in the realms of a political tangle over this within the Middle East itself, but it is going to be very vehemently opposed if that is seriously becoming the policy.
Tom, thanks very much. Tom Bateman, our State Department correspondent in Washington, and Tal Schneider, thanks very much, political and diplomatic correspondent for the Times of Israel. Well, of course, in his first term, Donald Trump had ambitions in the Middle East. And in September 2020, he announced the signing of the Abraham Accords, a treaty designed to normalise relations between Israel and its neighbours, United Arab Emirates and Bahrain.
We're here this afternoon to change the course of history. After decades of division and conflict, we mark the dawn of a new Middle East. Thanks to the great courage of the leaders of these three countries, we take a major stride toward a future in which people of all faiths and backgrounds live together in peace and prosperity.
Well, Jonathan Panikov was a senior intelligence official for the Middle East throughout Donald Trump's first term in office, and he's now at the Atlantic Council think tank. Before the meeting between President Trump and Mr. Netanyahu began, I asked him what he thought the American president wanted from this meeting.
What President Trump wants more than anything is to lay the groundwork and be clear that, unlike with the Biden administration, if Prime Minister Netanyahu would like his support, whether it comes to Gaza, whether it comes to Iran, whether it comes to Israeli maneuvers in Syria or in Lebanon, he can't treat him the same way that he treated President Biden. And I think setting that marker now is going to be quite important for President Trump. And I imagine it actually the message will get through.
So how is he likely to do that? What message is he going to deliver then in terms of how he wants the relationship to develop?
One of the challenges that President Biden had in being able to cajole Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu as much as he wanted to, and I think he was more successful than people give him credit for, but part of that was because I think Netanyahu, at the end of the day, long term, more than Gaza, cares most about Iran. That's where he thinks his legacy is going to be built. And he was never convinced that President Biden would really be there for him to support support Israeli action when it came to Iran. I think he was always skeptical. With President Trump, if you look at least some in the administration, my sense is Prime Minister Netanyahu does believe that President Trump is much more likely to either stand with Israel in taking on Iran or at least permitting Israel to take on Iran in the way that it wants to. My sense is that gives President Trump significantly more leverage than President Biden had.
Well, he certainly seems to be signaling that. He's signaled today that he is reinstating this maximum pressure policy towards Iran. That presumably is to try and reassure Prime Minister Netanyahu of his intentions.
I think that's certainly part of it. I think that's absolutely right. Look, the Trump administration, the reality is it's going to be fascinating because there is a clear divide. In the first term, almost everybody came out of the hawkish and neoconservative camps and was quite emphatic in terms of a maximum pressure campaign to go after Iran. That's not going to be true this time. You have a number of folks that are on the more isolationist wing that are really dedicated to not having the U.S. further involved in conflicts in the Middle East. And so the maximum pressure campaign that was reinstated today probably actually has a little bit more bark than bite. In other words, the reality is there's not a lot more to be done. There'll be some more individual sanctions, some more efforts. But at the end of the day, it'll be a question of enforcement when it comes to economic sanctions. The Trump administration will have to go beyond just economic pressure to be able to make any meaningful change in the relationship with Iran.
What about Gaza and his comments about cleaning it out, saying he didn't rule out Israel annexing the West Bank? Where do you think that goes? Music to Prime Minister Netanyahu's ears?
Well, I think it's probably music to the Prime Minister's ears, not so much for him, but because it helps him politically. It probably allows him to give to some of his more ultra-nationalist supporters and right-wing members, folks like Smotrich, the finance minister, the ability to say, look, this is what I've gotten for you. I don't know how much Netanyahu personally cares about it, but obviously it's potentially devastating for King Abdullah of Jordan, for President Sisi in Egypt. It's going to be quite a balance to thread that needle with King Abdullah coming next week. They're not going to take any of the Gazan population into Jordan. It would undermine the Hashemite kingdom, same with Egypt. And the reality is, at the same time, the West Bank has been a powder keg and is really a place, I think, unfortunately, waiting to explode. And that's also going to be a concern for King Abdullah.
So what of that regional context and what Donald Trump wants to do more broadly in the Middle East, continuing on from where he left off in the first term with the Abraham Accords, this idea of a broader rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia being the big goal? I mean, is that still, do you think, what he's focused on?
I think long term it is. I think at the end of the day, Trump really does want to be known as the president who helped bring peace to the region. I think the challenge is many of the Gulf states are in a fundamentally different place than they were during the first term. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, were both countries that were cheering on, for instance, a maximum pressure campaign, and today have significant rapprochement with Iran, and I think are going to be loath to push too far down that road. The same is with Gaza. Whatever plans were being made for Saudi normalization on October 6, 2023, and they certainly were advancing, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, sees himself as, frankly, not just the leader of Saudi Arabia, but the leader of the Arab world. And he can't just forget about or dismiss the very loud calls on the Arab street, frankly, for an independent sovereign state of Palestine, something Israel is not willing to come close to giving right now.
That was Jonathan Panikov, senior U.S. intelligence official for the Middle East during Donald Trump's first term in office.
I'm Nicola Coughlan, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Youngest Heroes. Rebellion, risk, and the radical power of youth.
She thought, right, I'll just do it. She thought about others rather than herself.
12 stories of extraordinary young people from across history.
There's a real sense of urgency in them, that resistance has to be mounted, it has to be mounted now.
Follow History's Youngest Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Police in Sweden say that about 10 people have been killed in a shooting on an education campus in the central city of Örebro. They believe the gunman is among the dead and that he acted alone. They're saying his motive remains unclear at the moment and he doesn't appear to have had any connection to a gang. The shooting took place at a college for adults, but there are also schools for children on the campus. A video in social media appears to show the attack underway at the Risbergska school. The footage is filmed from a bank balcony, and in it, you can hear a woman saying, "The man is standing over there without a jacket," before the shots ring out.
Oh my God, they're shooting, full grotten. Oh my God, they're shooting! Oh my God!
Jonas Klassen is the head of health services in the region.
We've admitted 6 patients to the hospital, 5 of them with gunshot wounds. Of the 5 that received gunfire, 4 have been admitted for surgery, and they all have major injuries. One of them have sustained life-threatening injuries.
At a news conference in Stockholm this evening, the Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson said the authorities still had questions.
We already said that brutalt.
Today we have seen brutal, deadly violence committed against completely innocent people. This is the worst mass shooting in Sweden's history. We are still looking for many answers, and I don't have those answers for you either. But there will come a time when we know what happened, how it could have happened, and what the motives behind it may have been.
And here on The World Tonight, we'll continue to follow the story as more information emerges. But let's turn now to a subject that we have been following here on the programme, the funding challenges facing UK universities. That was the sound of a protest in Wales at the Senedd today over the 400 planned job cuts at the University of Cardiff. The university pointed to a sharp drop-off in the number of international students taking up places. Well, international students pay higher fees and they cross-subsidise places for home students. Last week, we heard from Cardiff University's Vice-Chancellor, Professor Wendy Lana. She told us that if international students weren't going to come to the UK in the same numbers, British universities should be going to them. But another UK university which has gone down that route, Queen's University Belfast, has come in for criticism today after it launched a voluntary redundancy scheme for staff just days after unveiling plans for a new campus in India. The university had announced its intention to cut 270 jobs last October. That represents 5% of its workforce. Catherine Clark is from the University and College Union, which represents many of Queen's teaching staff.
Why it is prioritising expansion abroad rather than safeguarding jobs in Belfast, and considering that a significant amount of the funding that goes into Queen's University comes from the Department of the Economy, which means it comes from the UK taxpayer, to not be safeguarding jobs in this jurisdiction, we believe is a scandal.
The acting chief people officer for Queen's, Alastair Finlay, defended the decision to open the campus in India, adding that the current funding model for higher education did not work, as money from Stormont did not cover the costs of Northern Irish students.
We need to balance our income, our operating budget, and income and expenditure. This isn't just us. This is happening in Scotland, England and Wales. We rebalance in order to grow into the future.
The Northern Irish government told us all funding provided by the department is allocated for specific purposes. No specific funding has been provided in relation to this new campus or any redundancies. Well, Lord Willetts is a former Conservative Universities Minister. He's currently a member of the Council of Southampton University, which last summer became the first British university to be granted a licence for a campus in India. I asked him how he viewed the decision by Queen's University Belfast.
Universities are under enormous financial pressure, and that's fundamentally for domestic reasons, because with fees frozen now for 7 years and they've had a sort of 25% cut in the real resource per student. But when universities look abroad, they're doing that often because everybody gains. The overseas students who get a British standard campus in their country, but also the British university can cover its costs, can may charge a management fee or something. So it's certainly expecting as an absolute minimum to cover its costs and perhaps do better. the overseas campus could be a base for students to do a year studying in Britain, for which they pay a fee, and it may also be an opportunity for British students at their home university to go and study abroad. So these are basically a good thing for British students in universities.
Well, for students and for the university, but what about the staff who are getting caught up in this? 270 jobs going at Queen's. We've also got the announcement last week from Cardiff. They might have to lose around 400 posts.
I think that's terrible, and it's because we have not been funding our universities here in Britain properly. The problems at British universities are not caused by their operating abroad as well. If anything, their operating abroad as well is a net advantage. One of the best things we've got going for British universities is their prospects of expanding internationally, and then partly as a result of that, attracting more overseas students to Britain and earning more revenues. That isn't the source of British universities' financial problems today. That is our own domestic responsibility, because we're not funding them properly.
Well, one of the reasons, isn't it, is that that pipeline of international students not hasn't dried up, but it's gone from gushing to a normal flow rate to a trickle in some instances. And that was a policy decision that was taken here.
The underlying trend is a lot of students around the world want to be taught in a university where English is the spoken language. So there is a massive appetite for higher education in Britain or Australia or Canada or the US. When you look at how Britain is going to pay its way in the world, then the ability to attract overseas students who want to come and pay to study in Britain is a great export opportunity for us. But it's the case, absolutely. Sometimes these flows go up and down, and some of the students from some countries were bringing dependents with them, which was, I fully understand, was a problem that people were worried about. So the rules on dependents have been tightened up, and that's had an effect.
Are there dangers in setting up campuses abroad? Certainly in certain countries where attitudes towards freedom of speech, perhaps, or freedom of religion might be different. How do universities balance that with this glittering prize of a campus abroad that might make net revenue?
There are undoubtedly a range of very tricky issues that you do face when you are operating abroad. And to be honest, saying I'm ultimately regulated from the UK, and indeed you're valuing the fact that at the end of this is a British degree, is one of the bastions we've got to protect our values in those circumstances.
So just to be clear, Southampton University, you sit on the council. Is that then part of the deal that it has struck with the authorities in Gujarat?
For me, at Southampton, I'm very pleased that we're setting up a campus in India, and I think that is great for India, and I think it is also great and a strength for the University of Southampton here in Britain. There is a big wide world out there, and there's a slight tendency to think of universities as a kind of cottage industry, and oddly enough, lots of other countries have been far more ambitious than us in realising they should operate in a range of countries, they should operate in different continents, they should make it easier for students to move from one campus to another. All that is part of how global higher education is changing. And for me, it's frustrating. If anything, Britain, with the reputation of our higher education system, has not done as much as it might have done to operate like that.
And that was Lord Willetts there. Now it is olive harvest time in Spain. And in 2021, the world's largest producer of olive oil began suffering a punishing drought. Production plummeted and the price of the liquid gold soared. The 2024 to 2025 olive season has been better in Spain, but farmers are still watching the sky. And apart from climate change, there is also another cause for anxiety. Xylella fastidiosa is a deadly and hard to detect bacterium that has killed millions of olive trees in southern Italy. Well, in Cordoba in Spain, Dr. Blanca Landa heads up an international project at the Institute of Sustainable Agriculture dedicated to stopping the spread of the microbe. And Linda Presley met her at her laboratory.
It's a biosecurity facility, a quarantine level 2 facility. It's to avoid any escape from the laboratory inside or some entrance from outside from the street.
Inside, Dr. Landa and her team keep a collection of deadly strains of the Xylella microbe.
It's considered one of the most dangerous quarantine pathogens, and this is due to the huge number of diseases that can cause in very important crops such as olive, almonds, grapevines.
And the big fear, of course, especially here in Andalusia, is the olive industry.
in Andalusia, we have over 1.6 million olive hectares, so you can imagine the concern of the olive industry.
Xylella kills slowly, clogging the vessels through which a plant absorbs water. And the only way it spreads is through insect vectors. They feed on an infected tree, then carry the microbes to the next tree they land on. It's believed Xylella first arrived in Europe in ornamental coffee plants from Latin America. Dr. Lander remembers her first sight of the havoc wreaked by the killer bacterium when she visited southern Italy in 2014.
So it was like being in a field of like atomic war or whatever, because all the trees were completely died and drying.
The dying trees generated conspiracy theories. Scientists, an oil pipeline, large companies, even the mafia, all of them were blamed for the demise of countless olive groves. Farmers were distraught, chaining themselves to their ancient, diseased trees to prevent the environmental authorities from removing them, the only way to counter Xylella.
It was a very, very sad situation. They said, some of the farmers, to me, that they take care of the trees even better than their own child. Everywhere you go, you see symptoms of Xylella everywhere.
And have they managed to stop it yet?
No, not at all.
Italy's lost more than 20 million olive trees to Xylella. And it's been detected in parts of Spain too, although not yet in Andalusia, which is why Dr. Lander's research is critical. In a large, secured industrial greenhouse, she keeps plant material that her team's infected with Xylella, including 11 varieties of olives.
What we do, we inoculate artificially, trying to simulate what the insect does, that is using a very thin needle. We inject a suspension of the bacterium in the trunk of the plants.
Okay.
So we don't work with insect vectors. It's too dangerous.
Especially if those insects escaped. There's still so much that's mysterious about the bacterium. Dr. Lander knows the plants in her greenhouse are infected, but none are so far showing symptoms.
We don't know when something happens in the plant that trigger the symptoms development.
Do you know which ones are more vulnerable?
Normally, the older trees are more sensitive.
Part of the end game would be to develop olive varieties resistant to Xylella. And then there are efforts to attack Xylella itself. I asked Dr. Lander if the gravity of her research project gives her sleepless nights.
No, I mean, otherwise I won't sleep any day, but sometimes I had been very, very concerned, especially when we detected the bacterium in Spain. I will be optimistic. Now we are more prepared than before. We know exactly how to monitor our territory. I think farmers now are aware of what can be the problem.
Linda Presley reporting there. You can hear more about Spanish olive oil in this week's assignment programme here on Radio 4. It's called Liquid Gold Under Pressure. Now, they are called rare earths, but they are becoming an increasingly common part of geopolitical discussions at the moment. In the past 24 hours alone, China has said it would limit the export of some of these minerals to the United States in retaliation for Donald Trump's plans to impose tariffs on Chinese goods. Separately, Mr. Trump has suggested that continuing US support for Ukraine could depend on getting access to its valuable rare earth minerals, an offer that President Zelensky first made last year. So what are they and why are they so coveted? Misha Glenny is the rector of the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, and he made a Radio 4 series a couple of years ago called The Scramble for Rare Earths.
The rare earth metals are 17 elements on the periodic table, which are grouped together because of their weird and wonderful properties, whether it's to do with light or to do with magnetism and so on. So there are 17 rare earths, and then there are altogether 50 critical raw minerals on the US Geological Survey list. So you have the rare earths, without which we can't have lasers, we can't have wind farms, we can't have electric vehicles, we can't have guided missile systems, all sorts of things we can't have. The internet we can't have without these rare earths. But we also can't do without these other critical minerals like nickel, or lithium, or copper, or cobalt. And there's a big scramble for everyone to establish secure supply chains so that they have a safe delivery of all of these materials that they need for the great tech expansion that we're experiencing over the past 30 years.
So where are they to be found?
Well, they're found all over the place. Rare earth is a misnomer. However, you do have high concentrations in various places. So lithium, for example, you have a lot in South America. You have a lot in Southern Africa. You actually have quite a lot of lithium in Europe, but it's difficult to get hold of because of NIMBYism and because a lot of the lithium are in areas of special natural beauty and things like that. So this stuff is all over the place, but important ones are concentrated in three or four particular regions.
Well, one important region is the east of Ukraine, isn't it?
Ukraine is a mineral superpower. It has an estimated $20 to $22 trillion worth of minerals underneath it, about three-fifths of which are in areas controlled by Russia. So this offer that President Trump is mulling over about a deal with Ukraine has got Russia slightly worried, because Zelensky certainly has still got a lot of rare earths that he could give to the United States. America is principally very worried about its access to rare earths, because over the past 30 to 35 years, it outsourced not just the extraction of rare earths, but the processing of rare earths to China. Now, of course, its great rival. So if it sees somewhere like Ukraine, where it will be able to get rare earths relatively easily, then he will start to apply pressure on Putin.
So what about China? China has included some of these minerals in its export controls ahead of Trump's tariffs, which are due to come in next week.
Yeah, ever since 2010, when the West finally woke up to the fact that China dominates both the extraction and the processing of rare earths, whenever there's been tension between particularly the US and China, you've seen the Chinese put export controls, first of all, on the actual raw materials themselves, but also what the Chinese have started to do in the past couple of years, and they've now ramped it up, has been putting export controls on the technology required for processing these minerals. And if you don't have that technology, you're in big trouble. This is part of a growing tech war for dominance in the most advanced technologies between China and the United States.
So when Donald Trump is looking for other sources of rare earths, where is he looking, do you think?
Well, he's looking in Greenland, where there's very significant rare earth deposits. That explains Trump's greed at wanting to take over Greenland. There are also other key countries around the world. Chile, at the moment the biggest lithium producer, is incredibly important. Indonesia, where you have nickel. And then, of course, there's the blighted Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, where the latest round in the scramble for rare earths and other minerals has just taken place, with the Rwandan-backed M23 and Rwandan troops taking over Goma, all in search of these minerals.
You outlined at the beginning, Misha, all the key industries, the key walks of life where rare earths are so important. But if you were to sum up what's at stake here in this scramble for rare earths, what would you say?
I would say that this is a battle for the future of supremacy in robotics, artificial intelligence, quantum computing. Whoever wins this race will dominate the 21st century.
Misha Glennie's series, The Scramble for Rare Earths, is on BBC Sounds. Closing headlines tonight, the US President Donald Trump has said he wants to build a nice new home for Palestinians away from Gaza. And sources have confirmed to CBS News, the BBC's US partner, that all USAID, that's the International Development Agency, overseas missions are shutting down and all staff will be recalled by Friday. That is The World Tonight. I'm James Kamara-Sami. Good night.
When you're young, it feels like anything is possible. Maybe you're a little hot-headed, but your optimism lifts you up. And your righteous fury can be rocket fuel, propelling you to fight for what's right. You might make choices that put you in danger. You might even make history. I'm Nicola Coughlan. This is History's Youngest Heroes. Rebellion, risk, and the radical power of youth.
Being young, maybe she didn't think too much. She thought, right, I'll just do it. She thought about others rather than herself.
12 stories of extraordinary young people from across history.
there's a real sense of urgency in them, that resistance has to be mounted, it has to be mounted now.
Including a young man called Nelson Mandela, a firebrand who led the defiance campaign against apartheid.
Break segregation laws, ignore curfews, enter the door for white people at the post office, stand on the white side of the platform at the train station, and it's decided that black people are going to do this en masse.
And Lakshmi Bai, the Rani of Jhansi, India's warrior queen.
She was a small woman, leading her troops astride a horse, sword in each hand, taking on the might of the entire British Empire.
History is lit up by young people who act on instinct and stick to their principles. Like Julian of Norwich, one of the first women to write in the English language. A trailblazer, but at a cost.
Why would somebody choose to have themselves blocked up into a tiny little cell with limited contact with the outside world, out of choice?
And Lady Jane Grey, queen for 9 days, who refused to give up her faith and chose to face the executioner's axe.
You have someone who is knowingly risking death and then ultimately knowingly taking death because there is something that matters more to them than their life itself. And that's a fundamentally heroic position.
These are tales of saints, athletes, Hollywood superstars and pioneers. Some heroes are household names. Some have been all but forgotten, like Vasily Arkhipov, a Soviet naval officer whose extraordinary courage helped save the world from nuclear catastrophe.
Well, sticking to your guns on that submarine in that heat, that takes guts. That really takes guts.
History made by young people. Follow History's Youngest Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.